We are hearing from and talking about exciting new leadership in our game in this, the newest episode of Musings on Golf. Kelly Elbin back with you, along with Janice Self, our executive producer. And in a bit, you'll hear from Kevin Hammer, the newly elected president of the United States Golf Association. I talked with Kevin on Monday, and I got to tell you, folks, I came away so impressed, not only by him and his commitment to golf. He's been serving the game for many, many years, but really more almost impressed by the direction that the USGA continues to take on multiple fronts to improve the game above and beyond the U.S. Open and the major championships that they conduct. We intentionally held this episode of Musings on Golf by one day because Janice and I wanted to be able to comment on the press conference this morning that new PGA Tour CEO Brian Rolapp conducted on the eve of the Players Championship. And started promptly at 10 a.m. And by 10:30, Brian Rolapp had outlined six themes that he says are emerging to guide the future of the PGA Tour. Took a lot of questions. It was a very important press conference. Let's hear from Brian Rolapp about the first of these six themes that are emerging.
We are aiming to create a more cohesive schedule with a simpler point system, one where the best players compete against one another more frequently. Fans know who the best players are. They are the players who perform best on the course. Our competitive model will be built around elevating those who prove themselves to be the top performers inside the ropes. As we look at the calendar, there is an emphasis on playing our season from late January to early September. In terms of overall structure, inclusive of the majors, the players, and the postseason, we are looking at roughly 21 to 26 tournaments on a first track of elevated events with the best players competing for higher purses. Let me break that down. Today we have eight signature events. We are effectively looking to at least double that number. Add the four majors, the Players' Championship, our postseason, and the President's Cup or Ryder Cup, and you get to the 21 to 26 event range. And to be clear, we will have a second track of PGA Tour tournaments, which will ladder up to those elevated events.
Okay, so those ladder up events, very similar to what you see if you follow soccer or football in the UK with the Premier League, of teams being relegated, teams being raised based on performance. And so I'll just quickly walk through the other five themes that Brian Rolapp mentioned, and one of them is promotion and relegation. The second one he talked about was consistent fields. The tour is focused on what he says is more consistent fields at their top events, targeting roughly 120 player fields with a cut, which is exactly the number that you see this week at the Players Championship that begins tomorrow at TPC Sawgrass, down from 144 in prior years to 120. Third thing, they want to open big, and I like this a lot. They said, we want to open big with a marquee event at an iconic venue out west, finishing on network TV in prime time on the East Coast. Makes a lot of sense. Again, I could see this happening in the week between the NFC and AFC championship games with the NFL and the Super Bowl. Major markets is the fourth theme. And again, this makes a lot of sense. Brian Rolapp said, you know, this is still, we're still working on a lot of this, and he will have another press conference at the Travelers Championship in the summer. But the major markets are important. He said, there's an opportunity to bring the PGA Tour to more major markets where there's a strong demand for our sport and a chance to reach new fans. He mentioned Boston. He mentioned New York. He mentioned Washington, D.C., and it's true. Those are major markets that right now do not have a regular PGA Tour event. Promotion and relegation, back to what he talked about at the start. He said they're evaluating the role of promotion and relegation across our competitive model. We are further strengthening our merit-based system and leaning into what makes professional golf so compelling. Players earning their way to the top with every event having greater meaning. I think that last sentence, as part of that sentence, is really important. They're going to try to find a way to keep some of these lower events, if you will, so you have players who are playing well in those events who may not be able to get into these elevated events, who have a chance to get themselves to be positioned to get into those fields of 120, and those who aren't playing as well are going to be relegated. They're going to be demoted from those 120 down. So it's all about, as he says, meritocracy or performance. And then the sixth and final theme that Brian Rolapp talked about that is emerging for the future of the PGA Tour, enhancing the postseason. And I think you should anticipate still seeing three events that make up the FedEx Cup at the end of the regular season of the PGA Tour. But the two key words that Rolapp mentioned were match play. I think the tour is looking to work match play into the playoffs and create even more drama. Look, Brian Rolapp was head of business and media for the NFL for a number of years. Yes, while he was an outsider when he first took over, he's learned a lot. He's a quick study, and working with Tiger on this future committee that has been really the key to all of this. They're making a lot of progress, and as Rolapp mentioned, you should start to see some of this rolling out in 2027 with some changes, some tweaks to the tour. 2028 is when you're going to see a major overhaul that is in line with these six themes that Brian Rolapp is talking about. A couple of other things before we get to Kevin Hammer. First of all, on the backside of Kevin Hammer, you'll hear from Akshay Bhatia, who certainly channeled his inner Mr. Palmer with just a remarkable display of golf on the back nine at Bay Hill to win in a playoff for the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard. By the way, it's Bhatia's third win on the PGA Tour, all in playoffs. So whoever's got the gets to be the U.S. Ryder Cup captain for next year in Ireland, please keep Akshay Bhatia at the top of your list. I want to talk for a second about Gary Woodland. If you have an opportunity, if you haven't already, you need to Google Gary Woodland, PTSD, Rex Hoggard Golf Channel. On Monday, this week of the Players' Championship, Gary Woodland, who is a major championship winner, won the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, sat down with Rex Hoggard and talked about the post-traumatic stress disorder that he's dealing with. In September of 2023, Gary had brain surgery to remove a lesion that was pressing on his brain, causing a lot of seizures, and he's continued to struggle with it. And he was extremely open, emotional about it. Among other things, he said that he's felt like he's living a lie, that without telling people that he's struggling with PTSD. It's brutally honest. Always been a huge fan of Gary Woodland. He's a real a guy who's really given back to the game. And this is, while it's a tough listen, it's one that he felt was important to get out there. He says, "I just hope I give others hope who are dealing with the fear and anxiety that he's dealing with." Okay, I got to tell you, Kevin Hammer is indeed an impressive individual. Comes from a family of golf. All right, he was born into it. His father, Laurie Hammer, longtime club professional down here in South Florida, actually won a team event on the PGA Tour with Dave Stockton, and highly respected. And Kevin is heck of a good player at the University of Florida. Has been involved on the administrative side with the Florida State Golf Association and with the USGA for many, many years. And when you hear what he has to say, and as I mentioned also, the direction, the many things that the USGA is involved in that really impressed me, I think you'll be equally impressed with hearing from Kevin Hammer. You're going to hear from Kevin right after our good friends at William & Harry, and also our other corporate partner, the Friars Golf Club. Musings on Golf is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast. All of our interviews are archived. Subscribe, like, go there. It's all available for you. When golfer and entrepreneur Rhett Butler founded William & Harry Golf, he brought luxury, individuality, and performance to the game, while giving back through support of veterans organizations and suicide prevention initiatives. This spring, William & Harry Golf unveils its 2026 collection, perhaps the most innovative, most comfortable, and most distinctive lineup of handcrafted golf shoes. They feature vibrant colors in both exotic python and ostrich, and classic golf colors for our Calfskins line of shoes, which have already been recognized by Golf Digest, comfort and quality. William & Harry is the luxury golf brand with a conscience. built on trust in our craftsmanship, our values, and our promise to reinvest in the communities we serve. When you choose William & Harry, you choose a brand that stands behind every product, every cause, and the causes it supports. Visit williamandharry.com, the luxury golf brand with a conscience. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. He was born into the world of golf, and now our special guest today will help shape its future as the newly elected president of the United States Golf Association. From the cart barn of his youth, through the fairways in Gainesville, to helping guide the game at the highest levels, he continues to give back. And what a thrill to welcome Kevin Hammer to Musings on Golf. Mr. President, congratulations. How are you?
Kelly, that is very kind of you. I'm doing wonderful, thank you, and I'm just glad to be with you today. I've been a fan of your podcast and an active listener for quite some time, so my privilege to be with you.
Oh, Kevin, you're kind, and thrilled for you, and you know, I know your commitment not only to the United States Golf Association, but to the Florida State Golf Association. It's you know, being the son of a gentleman who went on to become the president of the PGA of America, I understand and can relate to giving back to the game, Kevin. So congratulations. And look, golf's always been at the center of your life. I mean, your dad, Lori, your mom, Marlene, running the golfer operation, the golf shop at Delray Dunes Country Club, playing collegiately, as I mentioned, at the University of Florida. I'm wondering when you finally, and I know it was somewhat of a formal thing where you were going to become elected, but when you finally were elected formally, what were the feelings to becoming 68th president of the USGA?
You know, even though I've been involved heavily the last 5 years with the USGA, last weekend in New York City, it kind of all hit you at once, and it was almost overwhelming, to be honest. I was very humbled and just thankful to be there and thankful for everybody being in the room, all the amazing people in this game that we all share. I mean, are my USGA teammates, our leadership teams, so many administrators from other organizations in the game gathering together. And it was just a real privilege, just a sense of gratitude. At the same time, a real sense of responsibility hit you.
Yeah, I bet. Was your dad there with you in New York when you were elected? And have you talked to him about, has he given you any dad-to-son advice as you embark on this two-year journey as association president?
Well, my family, a good bit of my family was in the room. My parents, my godparents, my wife, my children, and a number of close friends. And then obviously so many other close friends just throughout the game. So it was emotional at times, but very satisfying, and just a real celebration of the game and celebrating so many leaders and so many different facets of the game. But yes, my family and I have had conversations like this around the dinner table for decades, literally. And I know you're familiar with that, Kelly. But I think the overwhelming theme is just grateful that the game of golf has been such a big part of our life for so long, and we've learned so much from it. And it's made our family closer. It's made our relationship with others and our close friends even better and more meaningful.
Talk about that for a second. Kevin, the nature of our show is all about storytelling. And to say that you had a few stories growing up, and I threw that cart barn note out at the beginning. I read the story. One of the stories that I think it was in the Palm Beach Post, it might have been a Golf Digest, but you said, you know, you were basically raised in the cart barn. Talk about golf from the very start, right?
Sure. I don't remember when I took up the game. My folks built the first house in Delray Dunes in the late 60s. It was Pete and Alice Dye were designing the golf course alongside my folks and some friends. And the house we lived in was 100 yards from the cart barn and the clubhouse and the driving range. And my parents still live in that same house to this day. For 13 years, we left there in the summer, actually. It was very slow membership, seasonal membership in the summer. We left there. We got involved in running another golf course operation in the mountains of Colorado at Keystone Ranch. So all my teenage years, I either grew up in the summers out in Keystone, mowing greens and fishing balls out of the pond and picking the range, or I was back here in Florida going to school and working at the golf course and playing when I could. And it was just a beautiful way to grow up. So yes, golf, a big part of our life, to say the least, from my very early days. And it was just, I feel you can look back and think of the impact of that now. It was like having, dozens of sets of grandparents always looking out for you that were members of the clubs and forced me and some other young people there to play golf and communicate with people that were older than we were. They came from different parts of the country or the world, other members. And it just teaches you so many things and has been a real benefit to me. So, yes, I don't remember how it started, but that's, all along the way, it was incredible. It was either, like I said, being out there in Colorado and trying to get the elk off the golf course. And we had to take the flagsticks out of the greens every night because the elk, if the wind would blow, the elk would charge the flagsticks and leave hoofprints in the green 3 inches deep, or they'd roll around in the bunkers every day. We had to fix those. They rolled around the bunkers to scratch themselves. And, or down here in Florida, it was always one thing or the other. As you know, I used to tell my father, he should keep track of all these stories. It'd be a best-selling book at the end of a career.
Oh, no question about it. Please talk a little bit about your dad, Laurie Hammer, in terms of his playing prowess. And how many years was he the head professional at Delray Dunes?
Well, I didn't quite have your father beat, who, if I remember correctly, was a burning tree for 50 years.
Correct.
Amazing run. So
yeah,
he still lives in the same house. It's been almost 60 years, but he was the director of golf there for a bit over 40 years. And then, like I said, about 12 years back and forth to Keystone, running the two jobs concurrently. But my father played, got out of high school, had a scholarship offer at the University of Florida, played at Florida, was a good player there. Then he went to the first PGA Tour qualifying school and got his tour card, played the tour for a handful of years, and won once a two-man team event that he won with Dave Stockton, who's also another very close family friend. And then for a few different reasons, family and otherwise, got involved in the development of this golf course here in South Florida. Pete Dye's first in Florida and lived there ever since. And they asked him to be the director of golf. And he had one of those PGA, that was back when the PGA professional. I mean, he truly wore all the hats and still played and competed and won the National Club Pro in 77, but still played a few PGA Tour events. I remember he finished top 10, I think, in the Hartford Open, 10 years after he took the job at Delray Dunes. So he was always a good player and a great teacher and truly wore all the hats. And we all did, in a way, helping each other out around the club.
Well, I think that's very true. And I know there are still a lot of golf professionals who are that way, but I remember how visible my father was at Burning Tree. He taught, as you said, he taught the game. He was in the golf shop. He was visible. He was always seen. I have to imagine your dad was very similar that way. The members counted on him. They knew he was going to be there. And that, I imagine, was a big part of his extended stay of 40 years.
Yes. And I'm quite sure your father and my father must have crossed paths.
They did.
They were similar area, which is nice to think about. But you're 100% correct. I mean, he was the greeter, at the backdrop when the cars pulled up, and he'd start people off number one and welcome them and shake their hand, and he'd just walk in the range. And so it sounds like we experienced much the same there. But it was, no, we used to laugh and say they're the director of fun. I grew up in that world where, the director of the PGA of America professional, he or she is responsible for the quality of life at the golf club. Plain and simple, almost every aspect. And that's the way we lived.
Kevin, did your dad, I'm sure he taught you at a young age. How about some of your earliest memories of you actually playing the game?
Well, I was, again, spoiled in a way. My godfather, Bob Murphy, was our next door neighbor, old time tour player. We had a lot of tour players in and out of the club. And I can remember Tom Watson used to rent a place there in the winters a little bit. He was great friends of Murph's. And some of my earliest memories playing golf, believe it or not, or playing with Tom Watson at Delray Dunes. Tom Watson, my father, and Bob Murphy. And I can still remember, I was maybe 12 years old, and I chipped in for birdie on the first hole that I ever played with Tom Watson, and Tom two-putted for par, and my father and Murph just started giving him the hardest time that this 12-year-old was one up on him. You can't make that, you know, you can't. Then we'd sort of shared. We'd go shoot some hoops in the basketball out back of the house and go to Murph's house and shoot some pool. And, you know, just, boy, take me back. Those were good days.
No question about it. So pleased to be joined by Kevin Hammer, the new president of the United States Golf Association. So as you mentioned, your father was an outstanding player at the University of Florida, first team All-American in his senior year. Kevin, was it predestined that you were going to follow in your dad's footsteps? Did you ever entertain a thought of playing collegiate golf elsewhere other than in Gainesville?
That's a good, you might be the first one that's ever asked me that, but I think because my father and my godfather both played golf at the University of Florida. I think a lot of coaches, well, I remember Mike Holder at Oklahoma State telling me, we just figured you were always going to Florida. He did say that. I did entertain, I took a few recruiting trips and those were fun too. And I think for family reasons and that connectivity and maybe proximity to home pushed me over the edge. And we had a very nice college team golf. We were quite successful in college.
Yeah.
And but the best part of college for me was that's where I met my wife, and we were engaged young and married young and had children on the way young. And it's been wonderful. So when I got out of college, I went to work.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Hey, Kevin, do you have a favorite story from a playing standpoint, in addition to meeting your future bride? Did you have is there a moment, an event, a win, a tournament that stands out from your years in Gainesville?
Oh, you know, the team won a couple SEC championships and one national title while I was there. But I think my fondest memories really were crossing over with some great players. I was there for, they're a bit older, but there for a year or two with Chris DeMarco and Dudley Hart, Brian Gay and Paul Tesori, the longtime now caddy who was on our team most of my years that I was there, Chris Couch. I think just, you know, those are some bonds that are broken. And even though we don't see each other that often, might even be a few years in between, you kind of pick up where you left off. That's the beauty of youth golf, right? Junior golf, college golf, high school golf, great memories that last with you forever.
No question about it. It's one thing to enjoy the game, to love the game, to play a lot in the game. It's another thing to really get involved, Kevin Hammer, in the game. And I'm wondering, from a volunteer standpoint, why did you decide to get involved with the Florida State Golf Association? Eventually you were its president. Why did you decide to get involved with the USGA? What compelled you to do that?
I think a bit of it was organic, but just growing up in Florida and seeing the landscape of the game change so much over the many decades in Florida, you know, if you love golf, you can't help but get excited about it, the growth of golf around the state, and so many people move into Florida that are golf-minded. I think in the beginning, really, it probably had a little bit to do with my daughter. My oldest daughter was always liked her golf, liked playing the game, but kind of wanted to know more, you know, even who designed this course and how was it built and that sort of thing. And I remember she was playing in the Women's International Four Ball at a young age with a great family friend, Taffy Brower, who was quite a bit older than my daughter. And they won the event. And I remember thinking, well, that's fantastic because it's got about a 70-year history with all these incredible names on the trophy. But my daughter had mentioned to me that there were very few teams that even competed in the event that year. So through her, God was interested in this, researched it, and really realized this event was dying and this was too much history to lose. And so she and I both got involved, went down to the club where it was being hosted, kind of negotiated the FSGA taking that event over. And I remember thinking, you know, I can go out myself and I can play a nice round of golf once in a while, but to be involved in something like that, to conducting an event or help saving something that's important in golf, really resonated with me. So it was a real privilege. I had a long run on the volunteer board of the Florida State Golf Association for a dozen years or so, and they're just fantastic teams of people. And as you well know, being in the business of golf throughout your life, they inspire you, and they, you know, inspire you. And it's like, no matter how much you give back to the game, I think the game gives you more, and just through relationships and other. And so that's what started it. And then, quite honestly, when I rolled off that board of the FSGA, I was getting excited, thinking, all right, I'm going to free up a little bit of time between work and family and start playing a little golf again. Yeah. And the next day, the USGA called and got their hooks in me, and I'm so glad they did. And it's just continuing on this journey in the game. And one thing that keeps coming back to me is, you know, you think you have a sense of the size of the scope of the game and the power behind it, the positive power behind it. But it's like, the more you get involved in the game just ripples out even farther and farther and farther. And you realize that it's just a tremendously powerful force here and around the world in people's lives.
Speaking of the USGA, Kevin, for our listeners who may not understand the structure and how the United States Golf Association works, can you talk about your responsibilities as the president of the USGA, working with Mike Wan, who is the CEO of the USGA?
Sure. And it's changed quite a bit over the long history of the USGA, but the executive committee, which I am part of, is a 15-person volunteer board, in effect. We set the strategy, the policy, a lot of the programming and financial oversight to the organization. We work alongside the USGA's full-time staff, which is led by CEO Mike Wan, who's just an incredible leader and has developed a lot of talent across the organization, all divisions. So privileged working with all of them. But it's a volunteer board. We do call it the executive committee, and we've got a variety of people from a variety of different backgrounds, extensive experience in the game of golf, but also expertise across, it might be legal or media broadcast, or a number of us have extensive experience with our allied golf associations, the state and regional golf associations. And we're just, again, golf loving people that are giving back to the game, but we take our role very seriously, and we try to marry up coveting and protecting the traditions of the game with accepting and embracing and celebrating all these new forms of golf as well. So it's a great team and a lot of talent, and it's a bigger, broader organization than it's ever been now. It's we're hitting on all cylinders across all different aspects of the game, from youth programming all the way through to the U.S. Women's Open and the U.S. Open. So we're just proud to be involved, and we know we've got a certain amount of time on this board to do our best and make a difference. And I've got a couple more years leading the organization, and I'm looking forward to every day of it.
Yeah, I noticed Susie Whaley, past president of the PGA of America, the first woman to be elected president of the PGA of America, is now on the executive committee. So as you said, the variety of strengths that executive board brings, right? The tentacles, if you will, of the United States Golf Association are as broad as they've ever been, Kevin.
Very true. And, you know, it's not a typical corporate board. It is inherently a little different. The USGA is a nonprofit organization. It's a governing body. It's a rules-making body. And our board is in and amongst golf. You know, it's different than a typical corporate board. We tend to refer to it as a board plus plus. And, you know, we're out there in the golf space messaging all the good aspects of the game. But yes, we've got a slot on our executive committee currently that Andy North, two-time U.S. Open champion, holds, which is wonderful perspective, tour player experience perspective. We're very excited to have Susie Whaley come in, PGA of America, LPGA mindset, which we love, alongside Brenda Corey Keene, who's another new executive committee member out of Asheville, North Carolina, who's a legendary amateur player throughout her career. And yes, everyone, we value everyone's perspective and experience, and diverse backgrounds really helps us.
Kevin, are there particular, I guess you could say, organizational priorities that the USGA may have over the next couple of years that you're going to help guide? Are there particular areas that the USGA wants to help make the game, the structure of the game, better?
Absolutely. You're probably familiar with our anchor sites strategy. Yeah. With our Open championships, really across all our championships, that being Pinehurst and Oakmont and Pebble Beach, which Marion's right there with them. We've you know, there's a real strategy behind that. It's a pathway across multiple championships to a Women's Open or a U.S. Open that participate and help support our new U.S. National Development Program. So you'll see more investments with our, you know, and more emphasis into our anchor site strategy. Our U.S. National Development Program is a game changer. Mike Wan and the team really led that charge, and we're expanding it rapidly. Not only do we have Team USA for boys and girls, but through our partners at the state and regional golf association level and the PGA sections, we're identifying talent all over the country that just needs a little bit of help with access and instruction. And we're doing that through a state grant program that we now want to scale. So proof of concept in a lot of these, the youth programming, which is new, is there. Now we're ready to scale it. Another example is our Pathways program, which is alongside our longstanding Boatwright internship program. The Pathways internship program is taking young people from all over the country, diverse backgrounds, underserved oftentimes backgrounds, and helping them with jobs in golf. And it's wonderful to see. So through our partners, including our anchor sites, we're placing these interns in paid internship positions across the golf landscape. So this is all wraps up into our foundation, which is newly constructed, and we're making more efforts to endow some of this programming and further communicate and message all the good work that the USGA does. These are all new programs for the USGA just in the last 5 years. And there's been so much fun to be a part of and to help message and lead the charge on. And now we're ready to scale them. That's why I would just challenge anyone, if they truly got to know what we call today's USGA.
Right.
And all the different aspects of it. I'd challenge anyone that loves the game of golf to not fall in love with the USGA.
There's clearly a lot of good work being done. And I just want to expand a little bit upon your anchor sites. My brother and I went to the U.S. Open at Pinehurst a couple of years ago. And Kevin, I've been fortunate to, you know, my years at the PGA of America to work and attend a lot of, you know, terrific PGA championships and Ryder Cup. But man, I got to tell you, I was just flat out blown away from the moment we got off the bus, which, by the way, the busing system at Pinehurst was off the charts. And then from the moment as a spectator, you're on site, and the setup and the interactivity. And you're right. You did that obviously because why just go somewhere once and not go back there, you know, until 20 years later? You have to have some continuity, and it really shows. And I'm sure you had the same situation at Oakmont last year.
100%. You know, even though it might be 5, 6, 7 years in between visits, you get on a path of more knowns and less unknowns. You get a path of on continual improvement on that path. You get on a path of capital investment to that's efficient, that actually saves you money over the long term and enhances the fan experience and the player experience. So they're just, again, just the most amazing people behind the scenes that work on this, whether it's John Bodenhammer, our chief championships officer, to Jeff Hall, to Reg Jones, to Brent Palladino, to Scott Langley. I mean, and Liz Fradkin and Shanna Rouillard. And these are professional golf. Some of them are professional golfers, but they are the most professional golf administrators in the world. And they inspire us every day.
Yeah, and obviously you get to go back to great venues like Pinehurst, as you mentioned, every 6 to 8 years. Let's talk about the venue coming up this year. We've got the Masters that kicks off the major championship season in April every year. The PGA Championship goes to Aronimink, first time since 1962 that the PGA will be played at Aronimink outside of Philadelphia. And then you take the U.S. Open in June to Shinnecock Hills on Long Island. I believe it's the sixth time you're going back to that historic course. Historic club, rather. What, Kevin, what makes Shinnecock? And before I ask the question, Paul Bupka, my late co-host, a proud Long Islander, always called it Shinnecock. So I have to say, what makes Shinnecock so special? And what should golf fans expect to see as they watch the U.S. Open being played there in June?
Well, just to take one step back, we learned from Nick Price a few years back when he was on our executive committee, and Jason Gore, part of our leadership team, just how important venues do matter, even to the top most elite professional players, men and women. And, you know, they're saying was that venues matter, and where a player wins their Open Championship matters. It matters to them. So almost to a person, Shinnecock is at the top just from a design and beauty point of view and shot value point of view. On everybody's list, it's near the top. And so, yes, we are going back there. You know, we have a long history with Shinnecock, as you know, as one of the founding clubs of the USGA. But also, you know, it dates back to, I believe it was founded in 1891. We had a U.S. Open there in 1896, which was kind of a nice little side note. I think it was played at, you know, 4,500 yards or something, you know. So times change. But, yes, we were there, and we were there in 1986, 95, 04, 18. Now this year, and then we're going back in 36. So great partner, iconic venue, oldest clubhouse in America, Stanford White Clubhouse, built in 1892. Oldest clubhouse in America. That's kind of neat too. So we're doing what we can to preserve the look of that and not block it by too many grandstands. So it's a very customized U.S. Open Championship that we play there. But I just think that William Flynn design. William Flynn came in, I think, in 31, and it's still his golf course, the design, and there's just no weak holes. That's sandy subsurface, and if you can get the wind blowing, it'll be beautiful. In today's world, you need a little help from Mother Nature, and you know, if we get it, it will be the ultimate test. And if we don't, the players are the best they've ever been, and there's a chance, albeit small, that they go low. But that's how good they are these days. You well know that.
No question about it. How many times have you played Shinnecock? What's your best score?
Oh, that's good. I did catch it on a bit of a softer, breezeless day once and shot about par, but I've only played it a handful of times. And I didn't play it in U.S. Open conditions either. So it'll be a great test. We're sure of that. And, you know, like those sayings, we're going to get every club in the bag dirty there.
I want to ask a few questions regarding the industry. As you well know, and the golf industry is kind of made up of an alphabet soup of PGA tours and USGAs and GCSAAs and on and on and on. In your opening remarks as president of the USGA, you said that the game is strongest when it is unified.
Yes.
What did you mean by that? Does that mean the unified of all of these organizations? Where were you going with that?
A couple different directions. You know, I mean, at its core, I think the game brings people together. It's one of the beautiful aspects of it. It's why so many people do love it. There's nothing like meeting someone on the golf course and getting to know them. That bond is just different. There's a special energy there. You know, part of our mandate or mission at the USGA is kind of unifying the game through, whether it be handicapping or grassroots programming. You know, those are all efforts that help unify the game and bring people together, right? We mentioned how it does it with handicapping and across generations. A 9-year-old can play with a 90-year-old literally and have a game together and a competitive one if they so choose. So it's so unique. So these are all different aspects of unification. In today's world, though, you're correct. Across all the organization, there's been a lot of change, structural and leadership changes. And there are a lot of new people in the room. And we have been, and we will continue to bring those people together. And we realize that we are much more like-minded than we are different. We realize we all love the game. We're all doing our jobs at the organizational level. And I think, you know, in most cases doing it well. But, you know, on the couple little differences here and there, seeing how we can get over those and collaborate and compromise and bring people together. It's inherent in the game that the game brings people together. And so my message of unity was across all aspects, from, you know, the programming that we've historically offered to today's world. You know, and it also speaks a little bit to all the new forms of golf being played. You know, it wasn't that long ago, USGA, RNA, and other organizations might have had a hard time embracing some of the alternative forms of golf. Today's USGA, it's all golf. We love all of it. Short form golf, top golf, putt-putt. You're hitting a ball down the street with a stick. That's golf. And we should want to connect with that person. We should celebrate it. and help people transition over if and aspire to the traditional game if they so choose. But simulator golf, a huge fan of that as well. So we live in that world. We're embracing that world. And we think the future of the game is really bright because of all these alternative forms of golf as well. So that all speaks to the umbrella of the game and trying to bring more people under the umbrella. And once you get in there, you realize that we are so much more alike than we are different.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And to remain relevant, your organization, the PGA of America, whatever, you have to stay up with the times, right? You have to, I like the word embrace. It's true, Kevin. You have to embrace society and how it's changed and help make golf part of people's lives.
Completely agree.
Yeah, let me ask you, your point about the nine, the kid who's nine and the older gentleman or lady who's 90, but it's true. Did I see where the number of scores posted on the USGA's GIN system, where you had 1 million more scores posted in 25 than you did the year before? Man, if that doesn't speak to where the game is right now, that to me is a great barometer. It has to be something that you guys are very, very pleased about.
Yes, pleased about it. It's twofold. One, the overall number of handicap users has gone up, trended up a little bit, but it's also more rounds are being played. And a lot of people can relate to that. They see it. It's hard to get a tee time at a number of golf courses around the country these days. So it's all, again, it's the game is fired in all cylinders, and we want to not only embrace it, but, you know, help retain it. And that's part of, you know, back to our youth program, and that's part of these efforts. We've seen surges in the game before, and then it you know, we don't retain it as well as we could. And this time around, I think through technology, through the social rebranding of the game, you've got famous people, famous athletes, entertainers that, you know, it's obvious they are loving the game through social media. I call that the social rebranding of the game. The game is cool all of a sudden. And you've got more young people than ever interested in partaking in the game. And so it's incumbent upon us to help retain all that interest.
We're in the late stages of our terrific talk with Kevin Hammer, the new president of the United States Golf Association. I was struck not too long after Jack Hughes scored the winning goal in that dramatic U.S. victory over Canada at the Olympics when he was talking about USA Hockey and how much USA Hockey has grown and the brotherhood of it. Is that part of what the U.S. National Developmental Program is also trying to achieve in terms of getting kids into the game, growing the game, maybe on national teams and so forth?
Yes. So the U.S. was the only country in the Olympics participating in golf that didn't have an all-country team. And so to Mike Wan and leadership's credit, you know, we started investigating this and said, you know what, if the USGA doesn't do this, it's likely no one's going to do it. So let's do it. And let's step outside of our traditional wheelhouse here and create a whole new division of the organization. The interest level is incredible, Kelly, how many people are interested in helping the U.S. National Development Program. We had a choice to make. Do you start real broad-based or do you start elite level, smaller numbers? For a lot of efficiency reasons, we started with Team USA for boys and girls, the elite teams, but we're already broadening that base out dramatically. We'll have 40 state teams through our state and regional golf associations that filter up to the national team. 40 state teams. Incredible.
Yeah.
Broadening out from there, we've got our state grant program that's affecting hundreds of kids positively. We want to grow that to thousands and thousands of kids around the country. These are more access-oriented initiatives. So it's there's a ton of interest there. It's scalable. We couldn't be more excited about it, and you'll be hearing a lot more.
It's terrific. Final couple of questions. I would be remiss for my listeners if we didn't talk about the golf ball rollback. Kevin, sure. If you would please explain with you and the Royal and Ancient of Scotland, implementing that for both professional golfers and everyday players, can you give us a sense again, what's the timeline? I've read 2028, I've read 2030. And why do both of the governing bodies believe it's important to roll the golf ball back for all levels of players?
Mm-hmm. Fair question and a great question, and happy to tackle it. So again, just to go back, maybe a 6-8 year minimum process to get to this point. We're now getting close to the implementation phase between now, 2028 and 2030. Why is it important? You know, I referenced earlier how long the U.S. Open played at Shinnecock. Now, that was 100 years ago, but over the next 50 or 100 years, you just can't see that type of, or anywhere near that type of increased length and distance required. The footprint of golf courses, you've seen it throughout your careers, no doubt gotten bigger. Kelly, when you and I were kids playing the game, you know, 6,300, 6,400 yards was a long golf course. You know, then it was 7,000 yards. Then it was 7,500 yards. We're already at 8,000 yards. Those things affect that increase in distance and the footprint required to house a golf course that's really relevant to longer hitters and the top levels of the game. That increases the time it takes to play. It increases the expense. It limits access, as expense would. Shot values, strategy, affects design. It affects renovation costs. It affects the environment in a big way through water usage and other inputs that are required. So it affects the environment quite significantly. It affects location. So those are all things that part of our stated mission really in the game is to do what's right for the game over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And very few organizations are able to have that kind of an outlook.
Right.
So I'm going to get to the recreational game in a minute, but on the most elite level of ball speeds and swing speeds, you know, people inherently think the PGA Tour players are the longest. I would ask anybody to come to a U.S. Amateur Championship or even a U.S. Junior Championship, and you can see what's coming. You see the next generation. And we referenced it earlier, even not elite players, but just casual golfers. There are more young people and more athletes driven into golf now. So they might be a higher handicap, but they're hitting it longer and longer and longer. So all the data experts run all this for 10 years and spend a lot of money running these analysis on data. You know, I would ask you, Kelly, I mean, when you were, do you see more nets now or when you were a kid? You know, nets are everywhere now, right? On the sides of golf courses, driving ranges. I always joke we should all been in the netting business, you know, so over the last 20 years, it's everywhere. Yeah. So the writing is literally right there on the wall, and something needs to be done. Now, this initiative, it's been through a series of compromises. It's a first step, likely, but a very, very important one. And I would argue it's not enough to be called a rollback. You know, half the people we talk to out there want so much more to be done. So this is really what this becomes. This initiative is really about slowing down the pace of future increases. The game is going to keep getting longer. It has been. It just can't keep getting longer at the rate that it's been getting longer. Otherwise, we will end up with 9,000-yard golf courses in 20 years. So, based on all the metrics, this is really a retooling of the metrics, slight change in the metrics by which the modern golf ball is manufactured to more accurately reflect the modern game. And I would remind everybody that, you know, every day we play the game of golf, distance changes. Distance changes daily. We play in heat, we play in cold, we play in elevation, we play at sea level, we play in wet conditions, we play in dry conditions. And a couple of yards is negligible, and you just don't notice it. Those aspects of golf, those series of adjustments that we encounter, sometimes even shot to shot, those affect distance to an exponential degree, over and above what we're talking about with the metrics of the golf ball. But it is important to slow down future increases. Now, recreational game, 95%+ of the people that play out there, they again will notice almost no difference.
Really?
Again, those other variables will affect distance far greater. The current testing and data, you know, analytics and even soon prototypes, you know, show that the recreational game, I mean, if anybody can tell a 3-foot difference on carry, you know, then they're better than you can imagine. So the distance, that's why so many things were not addressed in distance, was we didn't want to adversely affect the recreational game. The recreational game is in such a good place.
Yes.
We wanted whatever change was made there to be negligible at best. And that's where it's basically landed. Top levels of the game, you know, you might see, you know, if that person that flies at 340, It might fly at 328. It's still going to be ridiculously long, yeah. But that is, it's very much needed and important for the next 20, 25, 30 years. You know, part of what we live by is we want to leave this game to our kids and our grandkids in a very good spot. We've always been proud to introduce our kids and our grandkids to the game of golf. We want to leave them a game that's in a good place. And this slight little tweak on the metrics of a golf ball will help us do that long term.
So my buddies who I play with at East Point Country Club here in Palm Beach Gardens,
yes,
the ladies who are playing at their local muni, it is for them, as you said, they should look at this as more of a tweak than, oh, for goodness sakes, USGA, you're going to knock me back 5, 6, 7, 10 yards. Why are you doing this?
No, the last thing we want to do is take something away from those golfers. Those, you know, by the way, the golfers that you just mentioned right there, that's what drives the game of golf, right? Yeah. It's the 100 million plus people around the world that play the game that really drive the game forward. So, you, Kelly, for me, and for those players, quite honestly, the difference is negligible. And I again go back to distance isn't static. Every day we play, oftentimes hour to hour, distance is different, and we adjust almost automatically. And this change, the way it currently sits, the way this change for the vast majority of players out there will be a negligible difference at best.
Kevin, two final questions. One, before we started our conversation, we talked off air about the U.S. Adaptive Open.
Yes.
Talked and our buddy Dennis Walters and so many who have, who deal with disabilities of some form or another. And what that event has meant, with the United States Golf Association obviously made a decision to start a national championship. And you said just the mere fact of being there at the beginning of the event, how people feel who participate in that. It is truly a unique event, Kevin.
I've been saying it's our most inspirational championship. And yes, Kelly, if you go there and you participate, volunteer just to spectate, you won't believe what you see. These people are heroes. And the opening ceremonies of the Adaptive Open Championship it feels like the trophy presentation on Sunday at any other championship. Everyone is so positive, so happy to be there in an organized fashion and have a national championship that is their own.
Yeah.
There's such a sense of pride and success and overcoming obstacles. And I would encourage any parent with children to have their children, get their children out there just to watch it for even just a few hours. It's oftentimes life-changing.
By the way, before my final question, is USGA.org the best place for anyone to go to learn all about what's going on with the United States Golf Association and all the areas of the game you touch?
That's a very good source, no doubt about it. And I would encourage everybody to follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn and every other social media outlet, because there is a lot of information there. Like I said earlier, it's a bigger, broader organization than ever before. And follow us on social media, because again, once you get to know, it still is amazing to me the number of people that have been in golf most of their life, but they still only know the USGA through that prism of championships and rules and maybe handicapping. There's so many other aspects of the organization that are equally as beautiful. I can't wait for more people to get to know them, because you will love the USGA and the people behind the USGA once you do.
Well, the agronomic side and everything you do there is just a great example.
The grain section, 105 years old. You know, most people don't realize that oftentimes the Super Bowl that's being played is on grass that was developed by the USGA. You know, so these are all things that are just amazing. Coming up with more environmentally friendly grasses that require less inputs and less water. A lot of money and a lot of time and effort is spent into that department. And it's just critical, not just for golf, but for society.
Kevin, final question. It's one that has elicited a variety of responses, and I've had the good fortune of asking
I have a feeling I know what it is. Other podcasts I've listened to.
Yeah, of rounding out a dream foursome and being able to tee it up one time with
with three others, whether they're still with us, Kevin Hammer, or they've passed on. Who would those three be in your life, and where would you go play what would be a very cool round of golf?
That's a great question. So my mind right now goes to, we've talked about it a little bit, the beauty of the game and the cross-generational nature of it and how we want to be proud to leave this game to our children and our grandchildren. I think I might go with my grandfather, who sadly is no longer with us, on my father's side, who was a lifelong golfer and was very encouraging to me. And then my father.
Yeah.
And I'd like to be included in this group alongside my daughters, any one of my daughters that play the game now. You know, that would be fun. We've played a good bit of golf across three generations in my family, but if we could have had that fourth, that'd be nice. Who knows? It might be coming.
Exactly. All of your daughters play golf?
They do. My older one plays quite a lot and has always loved it. The younger two are casual golfers, and my wife is now getting into the game and loving it as well.
Yeah. Kevin Hammer, it has been an absolute pleasure having you with us on Musings on Golf. We wish you only the very best going forward over these next 2 years. And the USGA is in great hands, and it's going to be an exciting run. I know you're ready for it.
We've got a great team of people behind us, Kelly, and we all appreciate what you do to spread the good message of this game. And we appreciate your support and your partnership, and look forward to continuing all these conversations.
At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deer skin, calf skin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work, planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Thanks a lot to Kevin Hammer. I really appreciate his time. And as I continue to stress, you know, I'm a PGA of America guy, right? I worked for the PGA, great respect. My dad, past president of the PGA and so forth and so on. But man, USGA's really, I think they're hitting on all cylinders right now. And I hopefully you heard that in the time with Kevin Hammer. Talk about a guy who is hitting on all cylinders. Talk about a young man who made a strategic decision in Akshay Bhatia to skip college and play professionally. Three wins at age 24, as I mentioned, all three in playoffs, the most recent Sunday, with just a stirring back nine to catch, ultimately, Daniel Berger. Bhatia, by the way, was two shots back with three holes to go. Almost makes double eagle at 16 with that incredible six-iron shot. And then they go to sudden death, and he wins it. Two clips here from Bhatia. The first has to do with self-belief, something I think all of us struggle with as golfers. Hear what Bhatia has to say about how self-belief has made him a better player.
Just proving to myself I can do it. I think I went through a stretch last year where I was in contention and it felt like not impossible, but it felt like it took a lot of learning, you know, from each day that I didn't play well. And so this is another big step for me. I dug down. I believed and what I could do, and I executed nicely.
Yeah, he dug down, right? And a lot of pressure there. A lot of pressure on any back nine of any PGA Tour event, particularly with the size of the crowd there, the golf course they're playing at Bay Hill, always a tremendous test, the legacy of Mr. Palmer. And doggone if that kid didn't feed off of it. And here's exactly what he talked about of kind of really playing boldly.
Yeah, I mean, definitely played bold. You know, I think that was a big thing that everyone knows of Mr. Palmer. And it was really cool. I could feel energy and the buzz. It was awesome. I think the coolest part of today is just, you know, the fans, Arnie's Army was out there for me, and it was really, really cool.
I bet it was cool. I mean, it really, outside of winning a major championship or winning the Players' Championship this week, it really, I don't think it gets too much cooler for a tour player to feed off of the energy at an event named for one of the most iconic individuals in the history of our game. So congratulations to Akshay Bhatia. Big week coming up with the Players' Championship. Expect him to be in contention. Rory McIlroy, we're going to have to see about him. He's got a bad back, supposedly flew up to Ponte Vedra today from South Florida to try to defend his title. Expect Colin Morikawa to play well this week. It'll be a great event. Whether it is a major championship, whether it ever will become one, I think will continue to be a discussion point, and that's fine. I just think golf will always have its four major championships, but the Players it's not too far behind, and to win that is indeed a major accomplishment for any tour player. For Janice Self, Kelly Elbin, thank you for joining us as we close out another Musings on Golf.